People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. A new book has completely fascinated me as a result of reading a previous book by the man I'm having as my guest today. His name is John Kampfner. His new book is called In Search of Berlin, but you might know his book, which is called Why the Germans Do It Better. We're going to discuss those two books and a number of other things. But John is an award-winning author, a broadcaster and foreign affairs commentator, and began his career reporting from East Berlin during the fall of the wall and in Moscow during the collapse of communism for The Telegraph. And after covering British politics for the Financial Times and BBC, he edited The New Statesman. He's a regular TV and radio pundit, documentary maker, and author of five previous books, including the best-selling Blair's Wars. So, John, first of all, welcome.
Thank
here
you.
On the tip of Africa. It's
great to be here.
Great to be here. I mean, it's great to have you here. What I mean. But before we start talking about your books and that aspect of your career, why are you here in Cape Town? Are you able to tell me, or is it a secret mission?
It's no state secret. Okay. It's three reasons. Very good friends of ours from London, a South African couple, got married a few days ago. So we wanted to attend their wedding in Constantia, and it was wonderful. We're also here for some sunshine. If you are anybody who is versed in London winter or Berlin winter, we'll come to that, weather will know that after a while you get sad syndrome and you have to go somewhere. And I've only been once before to South Africa, but absolutely loved it. But also I'm researching a new book, which is provisionally going to be entitled Why the World Does It Better. And it looks at best practice around the world. And it's an excuse to basically spend the whole of 2024 traveling, which I'm doing.
Why not?
The only downside, and it's a serious downside, is obviously carbon footprint, which is something I need to be mindful of in the future. But it's got, I hope, a good aim. It's in this era of dystopian futures and everybody feeling incredibly miserable with wars taking place left, right, and center, and climate and all the worries we've had just emerging from a pandemic. I want to be looking at a dozen or so countries, or possibly more, who do one thing. This isn't a sort of macro view of a country. It's one country does one thing well. So I've been to Finland looking at its education system. I've been to Austria, looking at housing. I'm off to Costa Rica, looking at biodiversity. And here in Stellenbosch at the university, they're doing incredibly useful work on genome and identification of future pandemics, partnering with other institutions in Africa and further afield. They've just done a deal with an institute in Cambridge in the UK. And I really want to see what they're doing. I'm actually going there tomorrow after this program, and really want to see the kind of work they're doing there.
So it's quite a, on the one hand, it's quite a big thing to have taken on, but it also sounds that you really like the title of your book, which was so successful, Why the Germans Do It Better. And I remember when I saw that the first time, I thought, hang on a minute, that's a bit sort of arrogant.
It's a bit de trop to mix my languages. Yeah, I mean, as I like to joke whenever I do interviews or events about that particular book, the more accurate title would be Why the Germans Do Many Things Better Much of the Time. But that wouldn't have sold quite as well. And they're quite in the doldrums at the moment. They're all over the place on Russia and Ukraine. They're economy is going through a sticky patch. I mean, Germans are self-critical, stroke self-flagellating at the best or worst of times. But the general reaction I get much more from Germans than I do from Brits or else or other places is, why on earth did you write that kind of book? You know, that isn't representative. And I say, actually, if you compare it objectively to other countries, you're not in a bad place. It's just that you don't realize it.
Well, that's very, and also I like the subtitle, Notes from a Grown-Up Country.
Yeah.
And then when we get to the other one, In Search of Berlin, you can be quite rude here and there, but in an interesting way, and we'll come to that in a moment as well, John. But this title, Why the Germans Do It Better, I think helps to sell this book. And also, once you start reading it, this is my little compliment coming up, you become more and more aware that the title makes sense because of the way you've laid out the book and therefore makes a fascinating read.
It was published at a particular time, mm-hmm. which was in the middle of the first lockdown, August, September 2020.
Yeah. The worst time.
Mm. Britain was absolutely stuck in the mire. We had a clown as a prime minister in Boris Johnson.
You're famous for calling Boris a clown, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, he and I started out in journalism together. He was a buffoon then. He remained a buffoon. He doesn't know fact from fiction. His entire... I mean, I could bore listeners for the next 100 years on what I think about him.
I think most people would agree with you, just
I mean,
by the way.
One of my funniest lines came from a German friend who said to me that she had just given up her Netflix subscription because she got all the entertainment she needed watching the British Parliamentary Channel. You know, in other words, it's all this sort of mudslinging, yaboo sort of public school, in other words, private school, educated bunch of
toffs
who had no sense of serious public responsibility. It was all about winning a particular parliamentary battle. And the single serious, the reason I use that term grown up, for all Germany's many legion of faults, and they really are many, the thing I admire most about that country, which is partly, I think, intrinsic, and it's partly due to its war history and its Nazi history and trying to learn the lessons of history, is its utter seriousness. They don't take anything. They don't take democracy. They don't take electoral processes. They don't take responsibility lightly. And the juxtaposition in that period between the two countries couldn't have been starker.
But the British Parliament has been... Everyone, I mean, in this country, certainly we've all been amused and I think astonished by what's been going on with Boris Johnson and then Theresa May and then Liz Truss and now David Cameron coming back and Rishi Sunak. It's really what British people must think where their politics lie, I don't know.
Well, I think one of the things that winds me up more than anything else is that my British friends and colleagues and journalists over the years, I don't quite think they get, because Britain is such an island, I don't think they quite get just where their country is at the moment. I'm not trying to be declinist. I'm not trying to be nihilistic. I'm simply saying there is very little sense, even among people who, quote, think like me, who really get a sense of just how isolated Britain now feels. I mean, its public services, by European contexts, by so-called Western contexts, absolutely desperate. We have local authorities, Birmingham, the largest unitary authority, Britain's second city, now declaring itself bankrupt
and
having to halve its budget. The National Health Service, the pride and joy, the one unifying factor in the country. You could talk about the royal family as well, but you know, I think we can part
that's
that one.
That's another thing.
But you know, the one point, the one sacrosanct aspect of Britain is the National Health Service. It's absolutely desperate. Young doctors looking to come to go to Australia or elsewhere, to Germany to practice because they just find it intolerable there. And then, of course, it then becomes a vicious circle. Education in trouble, social care in trouble, transport, a big mess. They were trying to build the one proper high-speed rail, and that's all but collapsed. So it's just in a terrible state. And the worst part of it is I don't think most people realize.
Yeah. We're going to talk about how much you love Germany in just a moment after that diatribe about the UK. But John, music-wise, what have you selected? What's your first piece you're going to share with us?
I love Don Carlo. It is my favorite opera. The version that I absolutely adore was conceived of and directed by the former director of the National Theatre in London, Nicholas Heitner, who I've got to know pretty well. It's constantly being revived at the Royal Opera House in London. and elsewhere. A good bit of Spanish Inquisition never did anybody any harm.
Real grand opera, just by the way.
Yeah, I mean, it is thoroughly dark, and it appeals to my sort of the misanthropic side of my character.
Okay, and you want to hear the duet, the baritone tenor duet. Okay, here we go. Verdi's music here on Fine Music Radio on People of Note, the duet between the tenor and baritone in Verdi's Don Carlo, as we said, a dark, dark, brooding opera. The first choice of my guest, the author, broadcaster, whatever, John Kempner.
Whatever, I like that.
Whatever. Well, there's so many things when I read through your bits. And the book that got me very interested in John Kempner as a writer was Why the Germans Do It Better. And now In Search of Berlin, the story of a reinvented city. But all between this, John, you are clearly passionate about Germany and Berlin.
Absolutely. I have, I started out in Berlin in East Germany, in the GDR in 1988. I'd actually spent a couple of years prior to that in Bonn, which was then the capital.
It was the capital, yeah.
The sleepy capital. Berlin being a big city person, much more to my liking, and after Brexit, I thought, right, I've had it. So I have basically commuted between London and Berlin for the last 5 or 6 years. I'm actually taking up an academic fellowship in September of this year, so I'll be there full time for a year, which is something I look forward to hugely. Berlin is a messy city. It goes against most people's stereotypes of Germany as being organized and clean. And even my two very cool 20-something daughters were shocked by the amount of graffiti and stuff that makes Berlin what it is. And it, at the same time, is the place. Somebody described it to me like this, that Berlin's deficits are all very clear. They're right in front of your eyes. But when you get Berlin, when you understand it, when you fall for it, it seeps into your skin, and then you can't get rid of it. You always, always want to go out of it. You always want to go back there. And I do. I can't imagine a life without either permanently or frequently being in Berlin.
Well, it says, I'm not sure I get Berlin yet, but I do, as listeners will know, I love going to Berlin. I have a very close friend there whom you also know. And then I go to the concerts and the opera, yeah. But also traipse through the streets and the parks, and it's fantastic. I like this. Over the past 4 years, John has walked the length and breadth of Berlin, delving into the archives and talking to historians and writers, architects and archaeologists. He clambers onto a fallen statue of Lenin. He rummages in boxes of early medieval bones. He learns about the cabaret star, so outrageous that she was thrown out of the city. And then I particularly like this paragraph, John. I hope you're listening carefully. Berlin has been a military barracks, industrial powerhouse, center of learning, hotbed of decadence, and the laboratory for the worst experiment in horror known to man. Now a city of refuge, it is home to 180 nationalities, and more than a quarter of the population has a migrant background. Berlin never stands still. It's never satisfied, but it is now the irresistible capital to which the world is gravitating.
Yeah.
That's quite a thing. I mean, you put there all the negative and very positive things about Berlin, because the one thing that struck me was the number of young people there.
Yeah.
It really is a young city, isn't it?
I quote early on in the book David Chipperfield, the architect who's done work here. He's very famous in Berlin, possibly more famous in Germany than he is in Britain, although he's very famous in both. And he talks about Berlin having been a Prussian Junker aristocratic idea. Then it became a decadent 20s idea, Babylon Berlin, we know all of that. Then it became a Nazi idea, a hippie idea in the West, and surrounded idea, and a communist one in the East. Now he calls it a young person's idea. And you very much get that sense that it's a young city. And I think the theme that I focus most on in the book is migration. It is a place, and I think the only equivalent I can think of, albeit in a larger scale, is New York. It's a place where people come to. And when they have come to it, they both bring their roots, but also they adopt the persona of their adoptive country, and more importantly, their city. They become Berliners. And in so doing, they keep on changing the city. And there have been all these different waves of migrants to Berlin in the past. Famously, the Jews and the Jewish story of Berlin. Of course, I focus on and have to focus on the memorialization of the Nazi era and the Holocaust and the horrors. And there is no horrific site that I have not visited. I became absolutely fixated on going to them all.
John. What effect did they have on you going to these horrific sites? Was it emotional?
I've been to a lot of them before. When I was in Bonn, I made a point of going to Auschwitz, which is in Poland, far away. I went to Dachau, the concentration camp, which is just in the suburbs of Munich, just at the end of the S-Bahn, the suburban railway line. So I wouldn't say I had been inured to it, but I have been, and I'm always, you would have to be a monster not to be affected each time you go to any of them. I mean, my relationship with Germany is necessarily complicated because my father, who hailed from Bratislava, now the capital of Slovakia, then the capital of Czechoslovakia, and previously known by its German name, Pressburg, he was a German speaker, but he fled in 1939 after Hitler had invaded Czechoslovakia. He'd somehow, with his parents, and I really regret never having asked him properly before he passed away 10 years or so ago, he made his way through Germany and out again to Belgium and to Britain. And then
he was Jewish, was he?
He was Jewish. Yeah, and my mother from Chatham in Kent, a very poor working class town in Kent, they both met very romantically on the British military ward in Singapore, where he was doing his national service as a doctor, as a trainee GP, and she was one of the first nurses stroke midwives in the National Health Service.
That is romantic.
Which is incredibly romantic, and I really do think they were, for their generation, one of the most multicultural couples they knew, because Singapore is, in a tiny way, as an island city, quite a rainbow nation, city,
very much
Chinese, Malays, Indians, Europeans together. And they were very much that couple. But anyway, so the Jewish history of Berlin is incredibly rich and complicated, and it's not just all about the Holocaust. I write about the opening of the new synagogue in the 1860s, which was the hottest ticket in town. People were sort of bribing and scratching each other's eyes out to be invited to the inauguration of this Bismarck was there and everybody else in 1866. So you have the Jews, then you have the Protestants, the French Protestants, the Huguenots, who were driven out of France by the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, where Protestants were told, no, we're not welcome, and many were massacred. They went to England, to the Netherlands, but many to Germany and to the area that is now Berlin. I talk about the Dutch, who were regarded as very good workers. Then you go into the Russians, and I devote two separate chapters, one to Jewish history and one to Russian history, partly because of the incredibly complicated story of Germany and Russia now. Mm-hmm. But after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, you had Russians of both sides. You had communists and imperialists, czarists.
That's true.
All together in Berlin, part of Berlin that you know, Charlottenburg, was nicknamed Charlottengrad because there were so many Russians there. Russian became the lingua franca for many people. And then you move on, you have the Turkish guest workers, and then after Angela Merkel's famous decision in 2015, you have across Germany wide, but many in Berlin, more than 1 million Middle Eastern refugees, and now you have a huge swathe of Ukrainians as well.
Yes, of course. We need to take a music break, John. And what is your second piece? What have you chosen for us?
Angelique Kidjo, wonderful. I mean, I couldn't be in South Africa on the continent of Africa and not pay homage to. I could have, there were others I could have paid homage to. I just think she's part French, part from Benin. Most wonderful singer. It's a bit of a cliche in Britain to say it, but and perhaps elsewhere, but I absolutely love world music, and I've seen her play, and she's absolutely wonderful.
Even we let Papa walk.
That was Angelique Kidjo and a song called Agolo. And it was a choice of my guest on People of Note this week on Fine Music Radio, the author and correspondent John Kampfner, whose new book, In Search of Berlin, The Story of a Reinvented City, has just been released. And what I've read of it so far, it borders on the riveting, I have to say, John.
Oh, thank you.
As indeed why the Germans do it better. But talking about this book, In Search of Berlin, in the introduction, you start off almost negatively, pointing out most of Berlin's faults, this 800-year-old city, which began apparently in a swamp.
Mm. It should never have been the capital. And in the two times when the decision was made, should it be the capital or not, a lot of people were opposed to it. One was in the first unification of Germany under Bismarck in 1871. There were lots more august cities with far more history than Berlin that could have been that. Most notably, Frankfurt. When if you think of Frankfurt now,
the great financial city,
but it doesn't partly because it was raised during the war. I mean, doesn't smack of history. And after the wall came down, after unification, the decision was to be taken: should the capital move from its temporary capital on the Rhine, the small town in Germany that is Bonn,
a little provincial town, almost.
Very provincial. I spent 2 years there, and I barely woke up. I mean, it was
a shame.
No, sorry, I'm being rude to any listeners who come from Bonn. Apologies. I'm always putting my foot in it to Bonners, but. A lot of people thought, well, actually, that is the modern Germany. It's entirely federal. It doesn't have a big, strong capital. It's not like London or Paris or, other great capital cities. Germany is different. And also Bonn being so very far to the west of Europe, bordering the Dutch and Belgian borders, felt very different. The Bonn Republic versus the Berlin Republic. So the vote in the Bundestag, the Parliament, was quite narrow in the early 90s to restore it to the capital. And Germany, as a result, is different because Berlin brings with it so much historical baggage.
Well,
and
absolutely.
Not just 20th century baggage, all the way through. If you think of the 30 Years' War.
I was going to say, you devote almost a whole chapter to the 30 Years' War. And it was part of the book that I managed to read before you came in. And it fascinated me, the intensity of that war and the effect it had on so many people for so long.
Well, per capita of population, it killed more people in the German lands than the First World War or the Second World War.
It's extraordinary to think.
And it's still, when it's taught still intently in Germany, and it's not taught in Britain, and that's not some giant conspiracy theory, it's just because it didn't reach British shores. And the extent to which it still seeps into the consciousness, and I think it helped drive one of the several factors driving what I regard as well-meaning but thoroughly naive and quite often dangerous German pacifism. One could talk about Russia and Germany's approach to Russia. But when you think of, and I'm jumping forward now to the Second World War, and I'll use a very long German compound word, Vergangenheitsbewältigung, which means coming to terms with history, which is one of the things that contemporary Germany is regarded most positively about. Mm-hmm. One of my contentions is absolutely that is correct, but they've sort of learnt the wrong bit of history or learnt the wrong lesson of history. When they say never again, in my book, it should be never again fascism, dictatorship. But in the minds of Germans, it's never again war. And that had led to this layer upon layer of diminution of Germany's ability to fight a war, to defend itself, its over-reliance on America and NATO.
And it wasn't allowed to for so long, anyway.
It wasn't allowed to for so long, but even after it was allowed to, and it's one of the biggest negatives, one should say. I'm a great fan of Angela Merkel. But she allowed, after unification, the German armed forces to atrophy. And in some ways, I mean, it was benign neglect. It was naive neglect. It was the end of history view. You remember Francis Fukuyama after the collapse of Soviet communism and the collapse of the whole communist realm in Eastern Europe and the fall of the Berlin Wall. This idea that the West had won and liberal democracy had won, and there would be no more war, and Russia and China would all become happy bedfellows.
Yes, so it would all end
happily
and
ever
look
after.
What's happened.
And look what's happened.
John, the first time I visited Berlin, the wall had already come down.
Mm.
And part of me almost wishes I had been there when the wall was up, when it was divided. And you were there, weren't you, as you said, in East Berlin, but you were also there when the wall came down.
Yeah.
And all that euphoria and hysteria.
I was sent by the Daily Telegraph, which was my paper then, to be its first correspondent to the German Democratic Republic, Germany. And it quickly transpired that I'd be its last correspondent to the German Democratic Republic as well. I still have my old, very quaint press card from that time. And I lived in this tower block just in East Berlin, in a street called Leipziger Straße, which in the 19th century was like the most chic, glitzy, sort of Times Square type of place, where people would go by chariot and horse and cart to these incredible new department stores in the late 19th century from their villas in the western realms of Berlin. By this point, it was a concrete jungle.
Yes.
One of the ugliest streets of Communist East Berlin, and that really was saying something. And I was right opposite Checkpoint Charlie, which was the American-run crossing point where Western allies, British, Americans, and French, could cross apparently unimpeded. Although,
but you could cross, couldn't you?
I could cross
as a correspondent.
Yeah, so I could go from east to west as many times as I like in the day. Although every time I crossed, the East German border guards insisted on stamping my passport. So after 3 months, I had to get a new one. But more importantly, I realized I couldn't report honestly from East Berlin if I was constantly in West Berlin, enjoying the nightlife. Nice restaurants and whatever else. So I did that as little as possible because it drove a wedge between me and my newfound East German friends, that they knew that I could do this. And rather insensitively at the beginning, I was sort of inadvertently rubbing their noses in it. So I stopped doing that and tried to live the life in East Berlin. I was very much part of a series of protests in a church called the Gethsemane Church in an area of East Berlin that is now the sort of chicest part of town called Prenzlauer Berg. Then it was absolutely downtrodden. And in this church, we had assembled a peace movement. They did. I was just a bystander. And there was one weekend in October, so 3 weeks before the wall came down, when we were surrounded by troops, by police, by barking dogs, by searchlights, and told to file out one by one on a Sunday night. And the interim East German leader at the time, by the name of Egon Krenz, had just praised the Chinese solution, the massacre in Tiananmen Square, as a good way of dealing with things. So we really thought that, either for them or for us, the few Western journalists that were there, that something terrible was going to happen. And I just want to make this one point, that everybody is so down on, Germans are so down on Germany, and East Germans are so down on unification. I have so little patience with this argument, because I go back to 1989 and the fall of the wall, which nobody could predict. I could not predict it at lunchtime on the day it was announced.
It did happen very suddenly.
And it did happen, and it happened by accident.
By accident, absolutely.
In the way it happened. Nor 11 months later the unification would happen as smoothly as it did, warts and all, mistakes and all. And I just think it's an extraordinary, and Germans have so forgotten this incredible miracle that happened at that time, that you had two countries. This was the most, apart from the demarcation zone in Korea, this was the line of control. This was the most militarized place in the world, and not a single person died.
It is incredible. And what the other thing that you point out, I read some in your book, is the wall has been down longer than it was up.
Yeah.
And that puts things into perspective, doesn't
Although
it?
I can still trace, as most people can who lived in Berlin at the time, exactly where the wall is.
It was fun doing that because there are parts, I think, near the Brandenburg Gate in there, where there's a gold or a metal thing.
They're these sort of studs on the pavement.
That's right. Let's have one more piece of music.
Well, just to, whenever I'm feeling a bit sort of down, I love, just as a great piece of uplifting dance music, two of the the great icons of sort of late 20th century British pop, one with a Berlin pedigree, David Bowie, and the other Mick Jagger. And it's a remake of Martha and the Vandellas' Dancing in the Street.
David Bowie and Mick Jagger. How about that? And the piece Dancing in the Street. A lovely choice there by my guest, John Kempner.
Not very classical, I must say.
Well, you know, we allow rules to be broken on this program. John, we spoke about you being there when the wall came down. We spoke about communism and all the rest of it. I mentioned that you also were reporting on the breakdown of communism. But Brexit, you spoke rather disparagingly about it, and I think most people can safely say, certainly in this country, I think a lot of people are pretty well look on in sort of awe at this awful thing that has happened. But it did affect you, didn't it, in many ways, Brexit? Mm. You were obviously very anti-Brexit, let's just put that
right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the single worst thing that's happened to my country, Britain, in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that it was such a small margin is the other extraordinary
thing. Yeah, and there are so many guilty men, and yes, they were all men. We could go into them, the Labour leader who didn't campaign for it, then Jeremy Corbyn, David Cameron who called it, Boris Johnson who just advocated it, but simply for his own vanity and his own ego, and Nigel Farage, blah, blah, blah. You could go on forever. Mm-hmm. There are so many consequences. The economic one, which people focus on a lot, and the GDP cut that has resulted from it, the fact that so many Brits are not able to trade anymore and trade barriers and all that. That's all in some ways repairable, I think. What is far more damaging is the psychological effect. I really do feel Britain is now an island drifting into the mid-Atlantic. Languages are barely taught. The sense of empathy with, association with Europe, our continent, is getting dimmer and dimmer. The knowledge of it, the reporting of it. And fine, if that's what people want. I mean, I regard myself as a European, at least as much as I do a Brit. I'm very proud.
You've got a German passport.
I now have a German passport, German citizenship. I'm incredibly proud of that. I'm not more proud of it. I'm just equally proud of it. I used to be incredibly proud, almost arrogant, about Britain and London as this great global eclectic center. Everybody, whenever you were around the world, used to say, you know, where are you from? Oh, I'm from London. People say, oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, how is it? And now when you say it to Europeans, they say things like, oh, how are you feeling? Or, you know, one German said to me, only partly in jest, is it difficult to get in at the airport? And then I jokingly said, oh, the strip search doesn't take long, you know, just to sort of, you know.
to lighten
the whole thing. But it just feels cut off. Mm. And for me, that is an epic tragedy, because I love so many things that are British, but I loved the fact that it was this great global and European hub.
Is your wife British?
She is British. She is also German. Our children are the same. She's also American as well. Ah. So we're, you know, Theresa May would have called us all citizens of nowhere, right? You know, and I'm, you know, I was born in Singapore. I'm proud of that too. I love going back there. I just love this idea of the single global world. We're in South Africa, the Rainbow Nation. I'm not trying to get all cliched about things, but I think countries that go down this route, you know, Brits sort of singing Rule Britannia and waving a plastic flag in the bath. You know, I just think it's such a sort of awful idea.
You mean you don't do that?
You mean I don't do that? Afraid not.
You know what, John? Do you spend more time in Germany at the moment than you do in the UK?
No, it's about 50-50.
Oh, okay. And your children, you've got two daughters, haven't you?
I do.
Are they also 50-50, or how does that
work? No, they're, I mean, all the family are in London, although my wife comes out to Berlin, and they do too. Mm-hmm. But one is involved in starting out as trying to be a theatre director, and the other is a young journalist writing for the Times. We certainly didn't encourage her to go into journalism, having two journalist parents. They're very international. I don't think they feel as passionately about Brexit as I do. They all feel strongly, but I think my views are really quite radical about it, because I just feel de-anchored now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good word, de-anchored, yes. Just to end, I suppose, on a slightly negative note, I was having dinner with a friend the other day talking about how many people are leaving a country, this country, because of problems here. But he was said something which I thought was interesting. The world is dividing somehow. The world is more divided than it has been for a long time. Do you know what I mean? Or do you think you know what he might have meant? Because we're talking about this right-wing rise in Europe and elsewhere, the wars between Ukraine and Russia, the Gaza situation, and the Trump in the wings?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the prospects for, quote, and I really do use quote marks, Western liberal democracy have never looked more bleak. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very interesting question, sitting here in South Africa and elsewhere, about lots of terms to describe the middle ground nations, multi-aligned, non-aligned nations, South Africa, Brazil, you go around the world, Indonesia, India, and others, just how they are navigating. It's not a single America and Europe versus China and Russia world. Countries such as this one here, South Africa, have a huge role to play. And obviously decolonization is playing itself out through that. I wish South Africa wouldn't be so slavishly indulgent of Russia.
Is a big problem.
It really upsets people, because that's not the way to go. You do not improve the world by jumping into bed with a monster such as Putin. I mean, my wife and I, we met in Moscow. We live for 4 or 5 years in Russia at the beginning of the 90s. It is a wonderful country. It had so many incredible perspectives, but what it is going through now is nothing worse than 1930s dictatorship.
Yeah,
and that is the problem we all have. But the, you know, the world, one can be incredibly gloomy about it, but newly emerging political powers do have a big role to play in that.
We have to end there, John. I'd love to carry on talking to you about all these things, but just a quick reminder before your last piece that your most recent book is called In Search of Berlin, The Story of a Reinvented City, and also the one to look out for, Why the Germans Do It Better. And you will find, if you read these two books, why I was so keen to interview John Kampfer here on People of Note. And your last piece is The Ode to Joy, which has a Brexit link in your and how you're going to introduce it, doesn't it?
Yeah, just two very quick anecdotes on that. After the Brexit referendum of June 2016, I was invited the first and last time to go to the last night of the Proms, the great six-week classical music jamboree at the Royal Albert Hall in central London. And it's all a sort of British jingoistic flag-waving exercise. But I thought, right, I'm going to go to this one. And I went with my friend, and we had the European, the EU flag with us, and lots of us in the audience were waving the EU flag. And then, so I've chosen Ode to Joy because it is the great anthem for Europe. At the end of the German equivalent of BBC Radio 4 Deutschlandfunk, just before the midnight pips, they play the German national anthem, and then they play Ode to Joy.
Oh, really?
And
oh,
I would love it if, well, one day Britain would get back to the place of being in the heart of Europe. You could play the British national anthem and Ode to Joy
and
as well.
Joy. Wouldn't that be amazing? John Kampfner, thank you very, very much for a lovely, lovely conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.